Okay, so Matthew, before I hit record, I asked you a commonly held belief about writing that you passionately disagree with, and you said that it's hard. So what do you mean by that? You don't think that writing is hard? I guess most writers probably wouldn't think that writing is hard, but what do you mean when you say that?
So for anyone who's written before, you're right. I mean, we've done it. It's kind of like there's a system, we get it down. But anyone who has not written, they make it out to be this monumental project that it's really not. We all write, we've learned to write from a young age. Most of us, by and large, we went to school, we learned grammar, we learned spelling. We write every day. Even if it's you write a thank you card, you write a holiday card, we're all writing. We know how to get our thoughts on paper. It's a matter of then how do I take that to the next level of putting it into a
Yes.
book? And that's where people start to think it's hard.
Well, yeah, because I think this is just me, I'm going to play devil's advocate, but the writing that we learn in school is not the kind of writing that is going to make us a good book author.
That is correct. One of the statements I live by is good editors make bad writers good and good writers great. So you need, as long as you can take the first step and start putting your words on paper, even if they're not in order, even if they make no sense, if it's just another term, a brain barf, just get it on paper. From there, it's like a giant puzzle that you get to play with.
So you think you're saying that like it's the editing or the editor that makes the writing much more than it is the writer or the initial writing.
100%. I've written three of my own books. I've done probably two dozen client projects. And in every single instance, whatever editor I assigned to the project made that writing just come to life so much more than what we had done in the rough draft.
So talk to me about what it is that you do and how you developed your writing process.
Oh man, there's like trial and error. I've been writing since I was a kid. And I would write these crazy, ridiculous stories, probably from the time I was 10. And there was no rhyme or reason behind it. I wanted to create scenes and give people things to think about. And then as I got older and I went to college and writing started to get harder, quote unquote,
Yeah.
I shelved it for a while. And about 3 years ago, as I mentioned to you behind the scenes, I had someone who realized I had written three of my own books, which again, trial and error, those took me a lot longer than they should have and a lot longer than they take me now. But I
What
got
were
into
those three books
ghostwriting.
about?
So my first book was Career Readiness Manual. It was meant to
Okay.
be a kind of like a guidebook for younger folks looking to interview for jobs. At the time, I was a hiring manager at a financial institution, and just the candidates I was interviewing were, for lack of a better word, horrible. So I
Okay.
started picking out all of the things they were doing wrong and trying to give some relative advice for them. That was around the time I realized I hated my job. So the book morphed into more of a figure out what you love first and then go out and get the job, because if you don't know why you're there, it's not going to work. That rolled into my second book, which was Grow Up, No Really. And that was all about the things I think younger people need to know in life that they're not taught in college, like
Oh,
how to
that's
balance.
good.
I
And that's a
had to
great
find my,
title.
thank you. The cover is actually my son when he was, I think, 5 or 6 in an oversized suit. And it was the photo shoot was done at Grand Central. He was just angry carrying a briefcase,
Okay.
like from the scene, the movie Big.
Uh-huh.
And yeah, it was like 12 or 15 key things that I wished I learned in college. I have a finance degree. No one ever taught me how to balance a checkbook. No one ever taught me how to read a lease agreement for an apartment. And then I put out a fiction novel, which was a kind of a psychological thriller. And next thing you know, I have people approaching me asking me to write their book for them.
So talk to me about you have a methodology that you teach to make writing not feel like it's that hard. Is that correct? What is the methodology?
So the basic premise, the part that comes before anything is scheduling the time to write. It's absolutely incredible how many people think they can write a book or think they can't write a book, but they've never identified when they're going to work on the book. And if it's something that you just say, I'm going to work on my book this week. Okay, well now it's Friday, or and in this case, it's now Thursday afternoon at 4 o'clock. If I haven't done it yet, when am I going to do it between now and Sunday?
Yep.
right? So I walk people through the process of, you've got to make the commitment to yourself. Put it on your calendar, even if it's 2 30-minute blocks a week, just for 2 30-minute just for the time that you know you can write. You can't set yourself up for failure, and you can't schedule writing time at 5 a.m. if you're not usually out of bed until 8. You can't schedule it at 8 p.m. if you're usually
That's a good piece of advice.
On the couch.
Yep.
And then I break it down from, you know, if you think about the average book, I'm probably going to overshoot this, but 50,000 words for a, especially a business book. If you break that down per day, you only got to write 136 words a day.
But and you're done just thinking, but just thinking about it in those terms doesn't necessarily help that, at least not for me. Like, so I'm somebody that I set writing time aside every single day. I have dedicated morning writing time. But even for me, because I've never written a full length 50,000 word book, that it's not super helpful for me to go, okay, you know, I just need to hit, you know, X word count every day, because that doesn't, I don't have a lot of faith that that's going to produce a book.
Well, that is true. So that's the then comes in the second part. Once you've identified when you're going to be writing, so for someone like you, we would glance right past that because you've already got it. You're already doing it. Now it becomes more of the strategy questions and the why questions. Who is your ideal reader, right? What is your message to that reader? What's the problem that you're trying to help them solve? What makes you the authority that can help them solve that problem? And once we start working through that strategy and realize who you're writing for, why you're writing for them, then we go to the next level of, all right, now what is it that you actually want to say to them? And we just throw everything down on paper, right? So most of my clients are business owners, they're entrepreneurs, they're very, very highly specialized in what they do. So we take all that content out of their head. Like, what? Give me 5 or 10 buzzwords about the things you do with your clients or the things you do in your business. Those start becoming our containers for chapters. After we have the containers, we dive deeper on each one individually and tell me more about that. Tell me more about that. What do you need to do to get here? Before you know it, you've got a 5 or 6 page outline that you can then turn around and use that writing time to start brainstorming on.
Okay. So let's say I've got the outline. I have, I am now, you know, feverishly filling word quotas along this outline. What takes it from that to being an actually good book, that the kind of book that people, you know, would rave about, recommend to their friends, etc.?
Several rereads and rewrites by you, the author, before you let anyone else see it. Then you have beta readers, although actually, let me back that up. First, you're going to want to get it professionally edited. Their editing ranges in price. Again, we have ones on staff here. After you have it professionally edited, that's proofread and developmentally edited to make sure that it's coherent. Because as subject matter experts, I know I'm guilty of this. I'm 30,000 words into my next book, but I'm an expert on what I'm writing about. And when my editor looks at it, she doesn't always know how I'm connecting the dots because I'm leaving key pieces of information out. I just subconsciously assume people know. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So you don't think that the writer should be the editor. You think that it should always be separated.
Oh, in no circumstance ever on earth should you edit your own work.
Mm. Okay. I like that take. Why do you say that?
The human brain is not capable of picking up on all of your own errors. The human brain, especially when you've written it, it reads what it believes is there or what you intended to be there. I know this firsthand. When I edited my first book myself 3 times. I gave it to my sister-in-law, who's not an editor. She's just an avid reader. She found 400 mistakes.
Gotcha. Yeah, I think that most people are on board with the idea that you need a third party catching mistakes, 100%. But I think what we're talking about more is the idea that you need a third party that understands what makes for good communication of thought to edit it for that. Is that right?
So generally, my advice there, I'm kind of going to answer that halfway, and you let me know if
okay, please.
Like what I say in ghostwriting, when people ask me if I'm a subject matter expert in whatever they're writing about, my answer is always no, and you don't want me to be. So I'm going to tie that in here. The reason is if I'm an expert on something, I am not going to see those glaring mistakes, right? So I've got 20 years of finance experience. If you're writing a book on finance, I'm just going to understand what you're saying. And the average reader who has no idea might not. So your editor can be, they don't have to be a professional editor. Like they don't have to be a member of the Freelance Editor Society of America. It could just be someone who's really good at English, someone who's really good at grammar, and they're not too familiar with what you're writing about.
Okay.
Because the feedback you want from them is, this doesn't make sense to me, or I'm not really sure what you mean here, because that's how you're going to get what you need to make it cohesive and coherent.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree with that for sure. Okay. So you do that. When do beta readers come in?
Beta readers, after the editor's gone through it, definitely before you go to live publication. You know, if you want to order a few author or proof copies from Amazon or whatever publishing platform you're using and hand them out, that's when beta readers come in. I always give my clients and anyone in the writing community the word of caution that you have to really be discerning on what feedback you take. Because if you get five beta readers, you may get five different sets of comments and you cannot jump at everything someone says. However, if four of the five or five of the five all say the same thing about the same thing, that's probably something you're going to want to address.
Mm. Yeah. It's interesting because my own writing process is like, sometimes I apply everything that we're talking about. Sometimes I apply so little of it. The thing that I've always tried to apply is the idea of getting like a small group of my audience to critique the heck out of my work. Like if I don't get anything else, I get that. And then I just constantly iterate. And a lot of times it's after I've hit publish, but this is for kids books, so it's a little bit different. But like very shortly after I hit publish on a kids book, I'll start reading it to classrooms. And there's usually like three or four rounds of edits that I'll do from like when I've hit publish to 6 months after I've hit publish.
Oh, I love that. And you and I are definitely gonna have to have another conversation at some point, because a children's book has been on my list. In fact, my son's almost 10 now, and we were starting to talk about a children's book idea probably when he was six. And nice. I just never got around to it because I can't draw. And I don't really, here's where I'm going to say writing's difficult. I don't know how to write in such short and easy to understand ways.
Yes, it's a challenge. I've learned a few things over the years that, like, for one thing, I used to really not think that narration was that important, that, like, you know, the pictures are going to tell the story and dialogue heavy stories give you, you know, more opportunity for humor and gags and whatnot. But I have changed my perspective on that just after getting a lot more parents' feedback. Like when I give the book to parents and they read it to their kids and I'm not there to give my performance spin on the book. And they're like, well, this part confused me because I'm just looking at a picture and it's just not really telling me what's happening. So one thing I have changed my perspective on is like the importance of narration. But yeah, we should have a whole conversation about the craft of writing a kid's book. Like how can you tell a complete story in 600 to 800 words? That is my big thing. The thing that I push when it comes to kids books is, just like a DreamWorks movie, how you've got, they've figured out the plot that they want to tell, and then they tell it as a series of gags. In the same way with a kid's book, you figure out what it is that you're trying to say, and then you tell it as a series of what I call reaction triggers. So the idea is you're trying to get a reaction out of the kid that's reading the book. And that's what separates a book that, you know, a parent wants their kid to read from a book that the kid is grabbing off the bookshelf every day.
Got it. I love that. Yeah. If you were open-minded to it, I'd love to get you on my podcast because we've had very few children's authors on really going through that process. And it's always fascinated me that I could write a 350-page novel, ask me to write a 20-page kid's book, and I'm like a deer in headlights.
Nice. Yeah, I'd be super down. That sounds really fun. Getting back to what you were saying. So my big question, the one that I'm like pressing you on is, there's a difference between filling word quotas and calling that writing, which it absolutely is. Like filling word quotas is writing. That's the bread and butter, the basics of what writing is. Like, you sit down and you force yourself to write. But that's not what separates a book from a book that is really good and is going to get recommended. You're saying it's the editing. But I guess I'm struggling to get clarity on what exactly do you mean when you say editing, and how does someone edit a book from a lump of clay to something that people are recommending to their friends?
So just to be clear, it's not only about the editing, right? After, and I'm not big on focusing on word count, I use that as an example to get people to realize this daunting task is bigger than they're making it.
Yeah.
Once you have that outline, you have that strategy, you know who you're writing to, you know what you want to write about. I guess the one thing we should really specify here is you do have to have something valuable to say. And I'm speaking strictly in the nonfiction space here.
Yep.
Because it's all going to start with you. If you are not a thought leader, if you have not accomplished anything of any notoriety in your career, if people don't regularly seek you out for your advice and your consultation, you probably don't have a whole lot to say, which is going to mean off the bat, no one's going to want to read your book because you're not an authority on anything they want solved.
Yep. Agreed. So you got to have something to say. So just ask yourself, like, what are people constantly coming to you to ask your thoughts on, because they view you as an expert?
Exactly. If you are somebody who, I don't know, if you're somebody who managed to run a marathon after only training for 2 weeks and you figured out this hack, that's something to write about. That's something people are always going to ask you. How the heck did you do that? And then there's people, like, I have clients who have written books on sales because they've helped clients turn their company's sales growth up 600% in 12 months. And they're constantly asked, how the heck do you do things like that? These are pillars that give them a platform where people are already paying them to do this for them. So there's clearly some value in their words.
Yeah, I agree. I guess when I think about the saturation of the market, it's like there's a thousand books on how to get better at sales. And so it almost feels like it can almost feel subjectively like, well, why am I writing another one?
That's a great point. And I got to tell you, Timmy, I probably hear that objection from 50 to 60% of my clients before we ever start a book. Is that fear, that imposter syndrome of, well, there's tons of books already on this topic. And the answer is, yeah, sure, there is. However, what makes one sales book resonate with one person and another book not resonate with that same person? And what makes the one book that resonated with one person not resonate with another person? And it really all boils down to knowing who your ideal reader is. I like to use the psychographic profile. What are the thoughts, values, and beliefs of the people that you want to read your book? Similar to what are the thoughts, values, and beliefs of the client or whoever you're working with in your personal business? Because it's that voice, it's that connection that is what makes one book stand out to somebody and maybe not to somebody else.
I love it. Matthew, one question I like to ask people, especially when we talk about the practical of like how to do what you're suggesting, how can you envision somebody trying to do what you're suggesting? What are some of the pitfalls that someone would fall into who's trying to follow your advice on this podcast? How could they mess it up?
So the biggest pitfall I can think of, and I see it all the time, is listening to other people.
Okay.
Especially other people who have never written a book before.
Hmm.
Right. Think about it. If you want to learn how to play baseball, are you going to hire a baseball coach who's never played baseball?
Yeah. No.
So when you tell your friend that, hey, I started writing a book, or I'm doing a children's book, I'm working with Timmy, or I'm doing a business book, I'm working with Matt, and their cousin's uncle's like, oh, well, no one's going to want to read that, or blah, blah. You know what? Who is that person?
Yeah. And do you find that a lot of your clients are listening to a bunch of people that have never written a book before?
Well, thankfully for all of my clients, we meet weekly. So I'm usually able to nip that in the bud and just get them back on track and remind them that they are the subject matter expert. You know, sometimes you got to put it in cold, hard terms like, hey, that person whose advice you're about to listen to, Can they do what you do? And the answer is always no. Okay, yeah. Have they written a book? The answer is almost always no. So then why the heck are you listening to them?
Agreed. Agreed. How does your average run-of-the-mill someone that's trying to just get started writing their first book, how do they make sure that they are surrounding themselves with the right voices?
Yo, that honestly, that question might be a little beyond my ability to age because,
okay.
I'm going to tell you why. I don't want to just take an easy cop out, but everyone is at a different place in their personal development, their professional development. And not everyone has realized that some of the people in their circle are not necessarily supporting their growth. They're probably detracting from their growth. Other people have made that realization sooner than others. Like I know even and I think it's a natural progression as we get older or more experienced, our circle of friends and close associates tends to dwindle or shift because we have to change that negative influence where they're only in our lives because they're waiting for us to fail.
Yeah. Yeah. Agreed. Agreed. Well, Matthew, this has been a really fun conversation. If listeners listening to this episode only took away one thing from this episode, what would you want them to take away?
Just start writing. Don't judge it. Don't go back every 5 minutes and proofread it. If you have something that is burning to get out of you, and even if you don't know exactly what it is, sit down and write. It could be bullet points. It could be outline. It could be Trello boards. Anything you get down on paper or in any format that's out of your head is one step closer to bringing your dream of getting a book or a newsletter or whatever that project is, a children's book, to getting it out of your head and bringing it to life.
Awesome. And where can listeners connect with you?
Best place would be my website, www.penforhirenyc.com, all spelled out. And basically all my social media is Pen for Hire or Pen for Hire NYC.
Awesome. Great talking to you, Matthew. Thank you so much for being on.
Same here to me. It's been my pleasure.